And we might as well repeat chapter 18, text 34, because it's the same thing. He says, sorry, not text number 34. Always think of me, become my devotee, worship me, and offer your homage unto me. Thus he will come to me without fail. I promise you this, because you are my very dear friend. Krishna has said this in chapter 9, which, as I said, is entitled The Most Confidential Knowledge. And that is the final verse in that chapter. Then here, in one of the final verses of the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says the same thing. And just before he says this, he says, thus I have explained to you knowledge still more confidential. Deliberate on this fully and then do what you wish to do. Because you're my very dear friend, I'm speaking to you my supreme instruction, the most confidential knowledge of all. Hear this from me, for it is for your benefit. Then he speaks this verse. Always think of me, become my devotee, worship me, and offer your homage unto me. Thus he will come to me without fail. I promise you this because you are my very dear friend. So which purport should I read? Did we read both of them last time? We read chapter 9 last time, so I'll read this one. I think we read both of them actually. Anyway, in this purport, Srila Prabhupada writes, the most confidential part of knowledge is that one should become a pure devotee of Krishna and always think of him and act for him. One should not become an official meditator. Life should be so molded that one will always have the chance to think of Krishna. Previously in this subcontinent, life was molded in that way. We were discussing this afternoon. We passed a store called Vishnu Medicals in Medipalli. And someone remarked that everything in this country is there to remind you of God somehow or other. And then I remarked, because I live in North India, that it's not like this anymore there. Now we're opening up new subdivisions that are called Sun City, Flower Valley, you know what else, Central Park, I saw one outside of Gurgaon. These places exist now for the sole purpose of erasing Vishnu. We're envious of God in this world, and therefore we don't like to be reminded of God. There's a class of men right now in this country who are very avidly absorbed in erasing all traces of anything spiritual from the society. So when we hear this purport that life should be molded in such a way that one will always have the chance to think of Krishna, we can appreciate that there was some depth to the motivation of those who actually did mold the society in this way, and that it might not be so worthwhile a project to throw it all out the window as fast as one possibly can. We can say more about that maybe later. But one should always act in such a way that all his daily activities are in connection with Krishna. He should arrange his life in such a way that throughout the 24 hours, he cannot but think of Krishna. Just like now, we have the new superpower. Who is the new superpower in the world today? It's not America anymore, obviously. China, somebody says. Anything else? What about Putin? He's not going to give up so easily, right? He's going to make sure he stays relevant. One scholar in Santa Barbara, California, put it very nicely and said, the new superpower isn't a country, because countries aren't so relevant anymore. Why not? Because we have a transnational corporate class. And this class of person is engaged in creating the new nation, or the new transnation. It's a worldwide, culturally homogenized group of consumers. That would be you. Or maybe you've been elevated to the next level, which is to actually serve the project. But I don't want to say too much in mixed company, if you know what I mean. So, previously we had a civilization here in the true sense of that term, in that everyone was absorbed in Krishna. Somehow or other, you could not but think of God 24 hours a day. Just like the first thing an Orthodox person does when he wakes up in the morning is what? Huh? Surya Namaskar, somebody says. Anything else?
Pray to Guru Devi.
Yes. Maybe that's the second thing. The first thing you should do. That's right. Karakve vasate Lakshmi. Karamate Saraswati. Karamune tu Prabhate Karadarshana. Because you see something auspicious. Padram karne vishnuyama deva ityadi. See something auspicious, hear something auspicious, elevate yourself with your every waking act. And actually there's a way to elevate yourself with your every sleeping act as well. But elevation of the consciousness, this is called Shreyas. Two things we find in the Upanishads, Shreyas and Prayas. Shreyas means that thing which is super excellent, absolutely preeminent, and worthwhile in the long term, for your long-term benefit. And Prayas means that thing which is maybe easier and certainly more attractive, but it's mostly for short-term benefit and it may not really do you that well in the long run. What's a good example? Those who have small children know. Many people here have small children. You're planning for the child's education. There's no parent, I think, in the world who just makes no plan whatsoever for the child's education. Well, we'll think about that when we get there. No, you don't do that. This is not a sane human being. So, this is called Shreyas. Thinking in the long term, what's my ultimate benefit? It may not be very comfortable. I remember when I was 5 years old, in my backyard in sunny Southern California, there was a lemon tree growing there. And I used to swing from the branches of that lemon tree just like a monkey. And I was having fun doing this every day. Then one day they came and told me, okay, tomorrow you've got to go to school. And I said, oh, school, what's that? And then they told me, well, you've got to learn things, and then when you grow up, you can take care of yourself and you can have a normal life. And, oh, I wasn't thinking it. I thought that forever it would be just play. He said, this is called Prayas. Prayas. We would like to eat only gulab jamun. Because it's nice. It's appealing immediately to the senses. But in the long run, it's not going to do you. It's going to create a severe imbalance. If you know anything about Ayurveda, it doesn't work like that. Shatra says, you have to have six tastes, including the bitter things. Katha, right? So, Shreyas means you have the intelligence, and you also employ that intelligence with a modicum of sense control, self-control, such that you steer your human trajectory in a progressive path. That's called Shreyas. It won't work just to sell out to the ideal of unrestricted sense gratification. You see people doing this, even here, right? You see people doing this. Sleep anytime, stay awake all night, do anything, eat anything, everything, drink, be merry. That's called, well, it's prayas, and it usually leads to cancer. high cholesterol eventually, maybe heart attacks, because why? You get old. You can't do this forever. In the United States, someone that I know went to the doctor, and the doctor said, how old are you now? And this person said, oh, I'm 50. So then he said, well, then why are you eating as if you were only 20? You can't do these things forever. The body will reject it at a certain point because it's actually unnatural. The natural way to live is to live in terms of, well, in harmony with the laws of nature. Those laws of nature are called Ritta. What does Ritta mean? Any pundits here? The order of the universe, the way things are going on, the natural law, you might say. In a word, we call it nowadays dharma. And dharmasya hina pashupi samana. Without this dharma, we're not really any different than the animals, except that the animals can engage in sense gratification better than we can. Cows. Why are our senses called go? Because they resemble cows. Anything you put in front of a cow, she will eat. Until when? I think they will keep on eating. This is called Shreyas, pure Shreyas. So, human beings should have enough discipline and enough intelligence to actually steer one's own life in a really, truly progressive direction, up. And the whole South Asian civilization was actually aimed at this ideal, Shreyas. And it's not just Hinduism. This is like, there was one scholar, used to be in the University of, in Canada somewhere, I forget where he was, Aravinda Sharma. And he made a very astute observation that South Asia had all the linguistic, religious, ethnic, racial, political diversity of Europe. And yet, it had a salient cultural, cohesion to it as well, harmony. How is it possible to get people of different religions and different linguistic groups, different ethnic backgrounds, different castes? We have something that's explicit here. Why do I say explicit? Because it's actually implicit everywhere else. You can efface it, but you cannot erase it. It's there. Deal with it, as we say in English. So that just adds to the mix of the diversity of South Asia. And yet these people were able to live in relative stability for a long time, identifiable as an identifiable social group. Not necessarily Hindu, because the Sikhs also have this. In North India, the Buddhists also have this conception of dharma, is what I'm talking about, dharma, meaning Shreyas. This was always the key word of South Asian civilization until about 200 or 300 years ago. With that period coincides with whose arrival? 200 or 300 years ago. Who came? The British. And it's something to think about. The Muslims came beginning around 700. But in 700 years, they didn't have as much impact on South Asian civilization as a whole as did the British in only 200 years. And from the annals of the memory of Mukunda Datta Das, even 30 years ago, things were very, very different until the arrival of whom? Software engineers. Well, no, that's, you said it. You all are software engineers. I better not go there. But Star TV, no, and you know, this telecommunications industry, which is part of the transnational corporate class, corporate crass, I should say. But anyway, it just really has a great impact on the whole civilization, such that nowadays you can get places like Sun City and Flower Valley and pubs every 10 feet if you go to Bangalore, and Sneha Fresh Chicken every 10 feet downtown Hyderabad, and you know, Lakshmi Wine Shop everywhere as well. And who knows what else is coming? I was telling someone this afternoon, I was living in India until about 2006 in Vrindavan, and I used to frequently visit Delhi as well. And I never saw boys and girls mixing so freely on the street the way they do now. I went to take care of my elderly mother until she died for a few years, 4 or 5 years I was gone, 6 years. And when I came back, I saw this. And, you know, nobody was dressing like an Indian anymore. And I was thinking, well, what happened? Every year, I used to visit India from the United States. At that time, I was living in the 1990s. I used to visit every year, and every year I could see a massive change. And actually, now I'm living in India, and I visit the United States every year. And every year I see a massive change there, too. Where's everybody going? Where does water go? It goes down. Because we're impelled by the modes of material nature. We're not actually in charge of our lives. Our lives are being driven for us by dint of our submission to the process of Maya, the illusory energy. And particularly in the form of her favorite vehicle, which is the three modes of material nature. Sattvaguna if you're very lucky and diligent, Rajaguna if you're ordinary, and Tamaguna if you're unfortunate. You all know the distinction between these three? This is South India, you should know. Anyway, so I came back to India in 2011 and I saw that, you know, boys and girls are playing openly together on the train, and they're wearing Calvin Klein jeans and their t-shirts, and I never used to see this. Just 5 years before, smoking in public also, this is a new thing, even in Vrindavan you see it. So, anyway, the point is, until just a few years ago, and for thousands of years before that, there was a tremendous degree of cultural continuity here that we don't find anywhere else in the world. What kind of cultural continuity? When I was in college, they taught me that from 3,000 years ago, they have dug up, archaeologists, have dug up fragments of pottery that have the shape, the same shape as these talis and katoris that we still eat from today. They found shards of glass bangles, churiyam, we call them in Hindi, that women, you can still buy them in Lat Bazar today. From 3,000 years ago, that's what I call cultural continuity. I don't know what drove it. You can think about that very carefully. I don't think it was the mode of ignorance. But anyway, this is the point. The Dharma Shastras are compendia of injunctions meant to mold society's behavior in such a way that we are always elevated by our every waking moment. How you look at your hands first thing in the morning, where you bathe, what time you bathe, how you bathe, then what you do after you bathe, how you eat, how you sleep, how you mate, how you defend. All these things are very carefully molded in such a way that you will not be taken down. It's a concession for the animalistic propensities that we retain. Why do I say retain? Because the animal desires that impel us to act in this world are actually the psychological residue of who knows how many past incarnations of lower forms. That's where these desires come from. We've been there before. But now that we've been awarded the human status after a long period of spiritual evolution through different species of life culminating in the human form, we're expected to take responsibility for our future. Just as adults are expected to take responsibility for their children, and just as children are expected to take responsibility for becoming adults by going to school and other forms of discipline that may not be very appealing, but are ultimately most beneficial. When you're 50, you appreciate it if you take this path. So this was all brought to my mind by what I'm reading here. He should arrange his life in such a way that throughout 24 hours he cannot but think of Krishna. And the Lord's promise is that anyone who is in such pure Krishna consciousness will certainly return to the abode of Krishna, where he will be engaged in the association of Krishna, face to face. Now, we've been talking really mostly just about becoming human beings, because that's a daunting enough task in the modern world. All the odds are against you. If you want to be a human being, you've got to swim upstream vigorously at every moment, because the current is going downstream and going very fast. It's just like, how many people have been to Haridwar? You know. You've got to hold on to that chain, because if you don't hold on to the chain, you're going downstream, we'll meet you in Marut. So, this is human life. But beyond just becoming a civilized human being, full of knowledge and responsibility, there's something else that human life can actually offer us, and that is pure love. Actually, love is really what they say in English, love makes the world go round. As a matter of fact, lust makes the world go round. But love is an ideal that we cherish because it is natural to us nonetheless. It is innate within us, but we've got to know how to uncover it. Uncover means it's not presently perceptible to us, but it is there, and we intuit it for that reason. But real love means spiritual love. We were discussing this a little bit this afternoon. There are two qualifications for spiritual love. Those who are in Medipali, you may recall. What are they? One is that it has to be ahaituki. Koi hetu nahi hai. And the other one is that it has to be apratihata. It cannot be obstructed under any circumstance. If you have love that has these characteristics, it is unmotivated, means there's no agenda, there's no expectations, as we say in modern parlance, and it is a determined love because it's unconditional. Therefore, you can be that determined. Then that's real love, that's spiritual love. And this is only possible as a result of contact or connection, as Prabhupada writes here, with the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna. Or any of his other forms. Here we have so many forms. Lakshmi, Narasimha, Jagannath, Sitaram, Lakshman, Hanuman, Ityadi. So, prema pum artho mahan. Pancham purusharta, we say. There are chaturvidha purusharthas in human life. What are they? Dharma, artha, kama, moksha. And usually the way it works, unfortunately, is that people are only interested in dharma because they know that that's what produces artha. And people are interested in artha because with artha you can fulfill your kama. You see? And in less civilized cultures, we find that these four goals are not there. Or these three goals so far we've discussed. What do they have instead? Instead of dharma, artha, kama, they have kama, kama, kama. And they don't get very far because they've got no assets to work with. It's a most unfortunate situation. To live in the mode of ignorance is like living as an animal. But ideally, beyond even the fulfillment of your material desires, one should be concerned about liberation from the snares of the material world. What are these snares? The shackles that drive us on, chasing these illusory desires, life after life after life. Why do I say illusory desires? Because they're temporary. You fulfill one, another one pops up. You fulfill that one, another one comes up. You fulfill that one, oh, you can't fulfill it, sorry. You've got an insufficient karmic credit line. You can't do it. That also happens. Or you can fulfill your desire and you enjoy it, but then you're taken out. Because you never know when you're going to be taken out of this life, or when other things will be taken away from you, including people that are most dear to you. It happens every single day. Maybe we've experienced already. But so to be a human being means to be concerned with dharma and artha and kama and moksha. But we're discussing something higher than even moksha. Why higher than, how can you be higher than moksha? Because what do you do in a liberated state? You're liberated from the conditions of these three modes of material nature. You're freed from karmic reactions. You're even free from material desires. But what are you going to do then? This is the thing. People generally don't think about this. They don't know and they don't question. But in a liberated state, there is activity. There is personality. There are desires. There's every mode of transcendental variegatedness, transcendental variety. So that is the world of bhakti. And ultimately part of that, the most important part, the essence of that transcendental variety is the love within it. Real love, unconditioned, spiritual love. It's only possible in exchange with God and in relation to God. But this is what's being presented here. And Krishna is giving it, he's reducing it to a simple formula of four items. What are they? Manmana. Think of me always. We spent the first quarter of the class elaborating on this. Our whole culture, all the Shastric injunctions, our whole tradition is aimed at this point. Keeping God in your mind somehow, at all times. That's why we give our children names like Narayana, Keshava, Vasudeva, whatever. So, Manmana. Then, Bhavamad Bhakta. Bhakta, what does bhakta mean? Somebody who participates in Krishna's lilas. Or somebody who is following the process of bhakti. Somebody who is trying to awaken this real love. That person is called a bhakta. So Krishna says, be that person. Then, madhyaji, worship me. There should be an external display of this internal process. It should manifest on a social, practical level. That's called yajana, to worship. Make a statement of your love. And mam namaskuru, do so in all humility. Humility is not very much valued in the modern world. Why? Because it's not very much valued in the corporate world. And the modern world is dominated by the corporate ideal. It used to be we had a Varnashram system, a real Varnashram system. Kings were very noble. They honored and respected the learned Brahmins who actually knew something in those days, not Ponga Pandits. They're all gone. More or less, they're all gone. So who's left? Just the best that we can produce from amongst us are these corporate magnates who can explode the world. But anyway, manmana bhavamad bhakto madhyaji man namaskuru. And Krishna says, Mame Vaishyasi Satyante. Mame Vaishyasi. You will come to me. It's Satya. This is true. Pratijane Priyosi Me. Because you're dear to me, I'm promising you this, Krishna says. Now keep in mind that this is the second time he said this. Prabhupada also adds here, these words stress that one should concentrate his mind upon Krishna, the very form with two hands, carrying a flute, the bluish boy with a beautiful face and peacock feathers in his hair. This is the point. Krishna is the most attractive form. Alright, I'm going to stop here, but if anybody has any questions or any comments, I think that what we should recognize and maybe think about, aside from the fact that these four easy things any of us can do very easily, anyone can do these things, but think about the fact that Krishna mentions these things twice in the most strategically important parts of this conversation. In what he, in chapter 9, called the most confidential knowledge, and again in chapter 18 when he's giving what he calls his most supreme instruction, the most confidential knowledge of all. So, anybody have any questions or any comments?
So, carrying forward the culture in whatever, is that helping, is that adding to the spirituality of people, or if we can make some effort to preserve the culture, will that in some way help people in keeping up spirituality also? Or?
There's a very nice verse by the great poet and devotee Bilvamangala Thakur, in which he says, a person will be able to give stern thought to philosophy. Karkashati. In philosophy, you have to be very critical. You have to be unemotional. You have to think hard and ask tough questions. That's what philosophy requires. And he says, and a person will give komalati, sensitive thought, to sahitya. In matters literary, this is required. The opposite approach. Moreover, he says, nirantarati, ceaseless thought, to one's tantra, one's duties. One will be able to do these things only to the extent that one gives continuous thought to Krishna. What that means is that the culture is itself a vehicle of spirituality, as I said, at least in the sense that, as Manu and many others affirm, you will not be degraded if you follow the Shishtachara that you have inherited from your forefathers. That is a fact. You cannot be degraded. Ramanujacharya says this, everybody says this. At least you will not go down. You may not go up, it depends on you, but you will not go down if you follow Dharma. In that sense, the culture is the vehicle of spiritual preservation, maybe is a better way to put it. But ultimately, the system is useless without this spiritual essence. It needs a soul. And without the spirituality, well, unless Varnashram Dharma is infused with real spirituality, which means this uninterrupted and unmotivated love that I mentioned, pure love, then it very quickly degenerates into a system of mutual exploitation. And at best, it becomes a socio-religious system in which we exploit each other. But at the very worst, like in 2017, it becomes a political and economic system by which we exploit each other. But it's still there. You can't get rid of it. It's real. So you have to deal with it. The best thing you can do, as Prabhupada says, you make the best use of a bad bargain. And don't think that they don't have a caste system in America, even if the Americans try to deny it. The Americans, for all their pseudo-egalitarian values, they have never elected a woman head of state. Because they know that it's baklas. They know very well it's cheating. So, this is the point. The Varnashram ideal quickly degenerates into this ugly caste system. unless we actually have this pure love as a motivating factor. Because without that, what can you do but be impelled by the noise of nature? And those will eventually, as I said, impel you to exploit others or be exploited by others, depending on your karmic relationship. Is that clear? Now you can tell here in Singapore Township, you can tell looking at the girls here how long they've been in the company. You, just by looking at them, you can tell everything. Anyway, you know this.
So, how much do we encourage them to keep up the culture, or should we just focus on, you know, chant and read? And that was my experience.
The point that I'm making is that there should not be a difference. They're one and the same thing. But you can't have one without the other one. Without the culture, you're not applying these high ideals. And without these high ideals, just the skeletal vestigial remnants of the culture are useless. And their days are numbered. We see this. This is why India is disintegrating the way that it is. Because the soul has been taken out for all intents and purposes. But, you know, there's some degree of something left, and it's very, very quickly degenerating, especially in the last 30 years, as I said. The spiritual insight has to be there, otherwise the system is useless. But the system is not essentially useless. It has its value, but only when... It's like a body without a soul. Body who loves, you know, no matter how dear your relative is, as soon as the soul is gone, you don't want to embrace the body anymore, isn't it? It's just like that. Okay. It's late now. Anybody have any other questions or any comments? Otherwise, we can stop here.
Why did Krishna create Maya?
Well, to talk about the creation of Maya is a little bit misleading, because actually these things are all eternal. We are all eternal. And everything that you see is eternal, in some sense. But not everybody wants to accept Krishna's authority. And for those persons, Krishna has to make some arrangement. Just like when we build a new city, some city outside of Gurgaon, it's understood that some sector of the population is going to be criminal. You don't want them to be criminal, but they will be criminal, so you have to build a prison house. So in that way, some degree of the jivas, the living entities like us, they're going to want to misuse their minute independence, and they're going to want to compete with Krishna. Therefore, Maya has to be there to recondition them. She has to put them through the process of attitude adjustment, we might say, in which they undergo the hard knocks of material existence until they figure out that it doesn't work. So it's mercy. Maya means mercy in that sense. It's what we call in primary educational circles, tough love. Sometimes the parent has to be a little stern. When the children are nonsense, we turn them over to a very harsh uncle who will take care of them. That way the relationship is not just good, but the discipline is carried out, you see. Maya serves that function. Is it clear? We require it. That's the reason, in a nutshell. We require it. Anything else? Okay. Thank you. All those who